From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Linda Gartz, whose new book is Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. Six-time Emmy-honored Linda Gartz is a documentary producer, author, blogger, educator, and archivist. Her documentaries and TV productions have been featured on ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, and Investigation Discovery, syndicated nationwide. Her educational videos include Begin with Love, hosted by Oprah Winfrey, and Grandparenting, hosted by Maya Angelou. Gartz's articles and essays have been published in literary journals, online, and in local and national magazines and newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune. Born in Chicago, she studied at both Northwestern and the University of Munich and has lived most of her adult life in Evanston, Illinois. She earned her BA and MAT degrees from Northwestern. Set against the backdrop of the civil rights movement, Redlined exposes the racist lending rules that refused mortgages to anyone in areas with even one black resident. As blacks moved deeper into Chicago's west side during the 1960s, whites fled by the thousands. But Linda Gartz's parents, Fred and Lil, chose to stay in their integrating neighborhood, overcoming previous prejudices as they met and formed friendships with their African-American neighbors. Told through the lens of Gartz's discoveries of the personal and political, Redlined tells the story of a community fractured by racial turmoil, an unraveling and conflicted marriage, a daughter's fight for sexual independence, and an intimate view of the racial and social upheavals of the 1960s. When I spoke to Linda Gartz, I began by asking her to talk about redlining, both its meaning and its impact. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, redlining started under the Roosevelt administration, when the Roosevelt administration was trying to kind of jumpstart loans available to people to buy homes because so many homes were being foreclosed. And they started something called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. The Homeowners Loan Corporation sent government surveyors out throughout the country to cities everywhere in the country to determine what the housing stock was like in various neighborhoods and who the people were that lived in these neighborhoods in order to be able to determine if they thought loans were safe. If a neighborhood were absolutely perfect, it was labeled green, meaning these loans are good to go. And if it were really good and called still desirable, then it was labeled blue or colored blue or surrounded by blue. And if it was definitely declining, it was yellow. And finally, there was the color red. And red was put around communities that had either poor housing stock or too many foreigners, and I'm using that term in quotes,
right,
because they did talk about Italians moving in at that time. But for sure, if one African-American moved into a neighborhood, then that area was redlined, and that meant that there were no loans available whatsoever for blacks or whites in that neighborhood. There weren't mortgages, and there also were not, you know, housing loans like home equity loans you might use to, you know, get a new furnace or build a roof or fix your roof. So these were federal government policies. The FHA, in conjunction with these policies, refused to back any mortgages if there were one African-American person living in a building or in an entire development. And this completely locked African-Americans out of the housing market from 1933 until 1968, when the Fair Housing Law was passed.
Yeah.
And that meant that, you know, they, African-Americans now, have about 6 to 7% the wealth that whites do because they were never able to invest in property, which is how whites have built most of their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a very quick overview,
no,
but it really was an insidious, and it was a federal government
yeah,
policy.
That's an excellent overview, very elucidating. And actually, I was going to follow that up, if you don't mind. Do you mind if I read just a tiny section from the book, and then we can talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, no, I'd love it. Thank you.
So this is from the end of your chapter 9, which is called Redlined. And You write, white families like ours didn't consider the rampant employment discrimination that reduced blacks' incomes, meaning most could afford only older properties already in disrepair when purchased. Little money remained for upkeep, with the husband and wife often both working to pay off their contract and no loans available, neither the time nor the money existed for repairs. Then there was the insidious role segregation itself played in the decay whites observed. The 30,000 African Americans arriving in Chicago each year during the 1950s were forced into the limited housing stock of strictly delineated black neighborhoods in the Black Belt and Near West Side. Toilets broke, closets were turned into makeshift kitchens. With so many people crammed into inadequate housing, buildings and community infrastructure crumbled under the strain. But most whites never made the connection. White homeowners judged what they observed, placing blame for rundown homes and lowered property values in racially charged neighborhoods squarely on the new residents. Consequently, white homeowners believed that they had a strong economic incentive to keep blacks out. I thought that was such an important truth to share about the ways that this redlining created prejudice and furthered the segregation of whites and blacks.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I actually really learned through doing my research for that part of the book. This obviously is a memoir, but I needed to understand what were the forces behind the rapidly changing race in our neighborhood and whites fleeing. And I discovered that many of what we would have called common wisdom at the time, such as, you know, driving through black neighborhoods and seeing dilapidation and seeing, you know, no grass and broken windows and things that were in disrepair, the assumption was just, well, look at how these people, as the phrase was used, look at how African Americans live. Of course, nobody used that term in 1950s. But the point is that I'm sure that my parents did not know about these redlining maps, and I am sure most whites didn't know about these redlining maps. It was never talked about.
Right.
And actually, I discovered that the area where my parents bought a house in 1949 had already been labeled yellow, definitely declining, 9 years earlier. So why would they have bought a house in that neighborhood if they'd known that?
Right, right. Yeah. Now, your book is about this situation, this kind of cultural situation, but it also is very much a memoir. And I loved the way that you mixed your own personal family history with the history of the times. And also, I should just point out the way that you evoked the times was just a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So one very moving part of the book was the story of your mother's mother, whom you referred to as Grandma Kay. Mm-hmm. She suffered from mental illness, and her presence in your family's home was a very big strain, and it set up a lot of tension in your parents' marriage. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about Grandma Kay and your memories of her.
Sure. Would you like to start with my memories of her?
Yeah, sure.
Well, actually, my memories of my grandmother from my earliest childhood, and I'm saying I must have been a toddler or a couple years old.
Yeah.
We sat on the floor together rolling a ball between us. We'd sit at the front window and count cars, or she'd help me name the colors of the cars. So I never felt that I was threatened by my grandmother in any way. I felt that what happened, and especially I learned this after I found my father's diaries, my mother's case studies that she kept of my grandmother's mental illness, I discovered really just in the last, 15 years, the incredible strain that she put on my parents' marriage. I think she held her vitriol and anger for my father mainly, mm-hmm. because in her mind, which was, of course, a mentally ill mind, he had stolen her little daughter from her.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she never said this outright, but it becomes kind of clear in the way she behaves. She also gets very angry at my mother if anyone disagrees with her. She's a classic case of a psychosis. I mean, she is paranoid. She's delusional. She hears voices. She thinks things have happened that aren't there. She thinks people are out to get her. If she trips on a folded up a rug that got in disarray on the floor, she tells the family where they're trying to kill her. But those are things that I don't remember clearly.
Right.
My father writes about my reaction to my grandmother's trying to hurt my mother. then I'm a very little girl and I'm screaming, leave mommy alone, leave mommy alone. But he, his writing is what brings that memory back. I don't remember that. Mm. So she was very, and the other thing that was very insightful for me was the fact that my mother started a diary at the age of 10. So she records all these incidents of my grandmother's behavior, which at that time I would have called more anger management problems than psychosis, but a series of losses, the loss of her home to foreclosure during the Depression,
right.
The loss of her husband to cancer, and then I think the, quote, loss of her daughter to marriage just tipped her over the edge.
And so, yeah, now I remember that in the book there are moments where she has these sort of episodes, and it always seems to come before a big event in your mother's life. like a big wonderful event in your mother's life. So anytime your mother's about to have something nice happen, something terrible happens, that her mother kind of pulls her back into this terrible, sad circle. So did she have, do you know stories of her, like her own young marriage? Was she psychotic at that time, do you think? Or did that not really develop until after these losses?
My grandmother, I think I know very little about her childhood, but I do know that she did grow up in a rather violent household in Austria. Mm. Her father was an alcoholic, from what I understand. I never met him. He beat his wife, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that he beat his son so badly that his son, that's my mother's uncle, ran away from home when he was 15. I mean, my great-grandfather actually threw an axe at his son.
Mm.
And so he, and my uncle, that's my granduncle, mother's uncle, he came to the United States. We met him often, saw him. And if he ever spoke about his father, his face would turn black, I mean, with fury, and just say, I hope he's rotting in hell.
Mm.
So I think in a way maybe my grandmother, Grandma Kay, may have suffered from a form of PTSD.
Yeah.
I never heard that she was abused, but she loved her father. You don't have this conflict between children and their abusive parents. But she never, I think, probably was able to overcome the fact that there were these violent scenes in her home.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Linda, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book. It begins, so you start with a prologue, which sort of sets up what we're about to read about and tells
right.
about finding a lot of family papers that kind of start you on a path of discovery about your family's history. So, but after that, you really start with family history, that of your grandparents, and you set in our minds the situation of those relationships. So we already find out that Grandma Kay and your mother are very close, but also there's a lot of difficulty there. We also learn about your father's parents, who also were likewise not always a very positive presence in your lives, and his mother in particular was very hard on him. So it was interesting. I actually found it very helpful to have that background to draw on as I read the book and read about the way your parents' marriage evolved. So how did you decide to begin in this way?
Well, as you know, probably speaking with many writers, this is a long and torturous
yes,
path.
Yes, I'm sure.
When I found all this material, and I'm talking 25 banker's boxes of letters, diaries, documents, films, you name it, they saved it. I was somewhat overwhelmed, and I would make spreadsheets of everything I had to try to keep track of quotes that I thought were meaningful and would eventually make their way into the book. Actually, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, kill your darlings.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do plenty of that. But how did I decide? You know, it was over trial and error. I didn't know I was going to start the book this way. In the beginning, I had a sprawling family history that included the racial change in the neighborhood. I started in Romania, where my father's parents are from. I have quite a bit of information about that. And, you know, I just was so entranced by all this material that I had and what I was learning about my family. It was kind of like I wanted to put it all in, you know. And then, of course, you realize when you have 135,000 words that nobody really wants to read all that. So then I started the process of honing and getting rid of things. And it's just, it wasn't originally even to start like with the chapter one, which is about the racial change. But then I decided, you know, that is really the crux of the book. So let's get the reader right into that part of the story, in medias res, as they say. Did I pronounce that right?
I guess so.
And then I went on to, and then I felt that the background of my parents and their families was very important, because my grandfather had settled in this neighborhood on the west side of Chicago in 1912. So my father had an entire family history in this community, as did I. So when the neighborhood began racially changing, it wasn't like we had just lived there for 8 years or something. This was his neighborhood.
Right.
And I felt that knowing the kind of work ethic they had, the kinds of jobs they had, were very important to be able to understand a little bit about why my parents would have stayed when all the other whites fled. So that is one of the reasons I felt the background was important, but I way compressed it from what I originally had.
Okay.
Just enough to give the readers a sense that, okay, this family is invested in this neighborhood for 50 years before the first African Americans even move in.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good subject. The idea that you had to compress it down so much, and probably at the time you felt like you were losing a lot of information, a lot of detail that you were very attached to, as you say, killing your darlings. But from the perspective of a reader, I can just say that I found it all very engaging and interesting. And so I think it's so important to keep our readers in mind as we edit for them, because ultimately the book is either for you or it's for them, and you have to make that decision, right?
Exactly. And I came to the reason I just wrote it start to finish was because I could not decide what the core message of my book was supposed to be. So I just decided I'm going to write it start to finish, put in everything I want, even if it's the kitchen sink, and then take a look at it and say, okay, what is the real message that I want to bring to this book? And I decided that the racial issue about redlining should be the core of the book, because that is still with us today.
Mm-hmm.
We still live with these segregated neighborhoods that were created because of redlining.
Right. Now, that brings us back to another thing I wanted to mention, which is blockbusters, which are these fear-mongering real estate agents who worked, and this is back, I'm talking in the 50s and I suppose 60s, they worked to convince white homeowners that they should move as the African-American population grew in their neighborhoods. Can you just talk a little bit about the blockbusters?
Sure. Well, the fact that when African-Americans moved into a neighborhood that whites had fear of their property values going down was a perfect scenario for unscrupulous people to move in.
Right.
So what these blockbusters did, they were called blockbusters because it was considered that they had literally busted a block. They had broken the block if they had rented or sold to an African American, because then the whites felt, that's it, we've got to leave. So what they did is they used fear-mongering tactics to scare whites into selling to them cheaply. Because at this point, if an African-American had moved into the neighborhood, or if African-Americans even lived nearby, there was the threat, as whites felt, of them moving in and destroying whites' property values. So they would leave flyers in the hallways that would say things like, you better get out before it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might get a phone call at 10 at night, and the person on the other end wouldn't say anything except, they're coming, click. So they really, and sometimes they even hired African-American women to walk down the street with a baby carriage.
Right, that just blew me away.
Yeah, or they'd hire African-American men to drive in cars playing loud music and kind of dilapidated, junky cars, to make the whites feel like, oh my goodness, there must be blacks in this neighborhood. We better consider selling. Then they would go to the whites and say, you know, oh, maybe I'll give you $9,000 for your house this week, but maybe next week it'll be $8,000. So they scared whites into selling cheaply. That meant the value of other homes of whites started going down. And then they would turn these homes around and resell them to blacks at a highly inflated rate. And they couldn't get mortgages because there were no mortgages available, so they'd sell on contract, was what the term was. And on contract meant that if you were a buyer of a home on contract, you never had any equity in that home until you had paid 100%, unlike when you have a mortgage. You build equity along the way. So if a black person or family had bought a home, they could have paid 50% off, and if they missed one payment, they were evicted. And these blockbusters could then sell those homes over and over again and continue to make money. There's an excellent article that listeners can find online called Confessions of a Blockbuster. It was in the Saturday Evening Post in 1962, and it's actually written under a pseudonym, not by a real blockbuster, but this is a person who wanted people to know how this whole unscrupulous process worked. Hmm. And it's an excellent article that feels like you're getting an insider's view.
Okay, I'll see if I can find it, and maybe I'll link it on my podcast site when I post our interview.
It's on my website.
Oh, okay.
So
I'll find
anybody
it there.
Who ever goes to my, I've got tons of resources on my website, lindagartz.com.
Okay.
If people want to find anything.
Great. Now, the whole subject of blockbusters really reminds me, it makes me think of our current situation and just the way that fear is propagated to you know, aid certain politicians. I'm not going to name names or name sides or anything like that. But, you know, right. I think that certain people still and probably always will use these tactics to get what they want. And I wondered if you were mindful of these links as you worked, if you were mindful of this relevance as you worked.
Well, you know, I started this book so long ago. I mean, I was mindful of the fact that there was still there were still segregated communities. And the more I read about African-American history, like Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns,
yes,
and many books, like there's one book called As Long as They Don't Move Next Door, I became much more aware and in tune to the really terrible situations that African-Americans have faced throughout America's history. So I became much more sympathetic, I'd say empathetic, to what the generational experiences of African-Americans has been. So when I was writing this book, I'd say I had in mind more like, wow, this is, you know, we all heard about lynching, we knew about the Jim Crow laws, but when you actually get into the depths of the kinds of things that African-Americans were not allowed to do, like to try to explain to your six-year-old why she can't go to the amusement park because it's whites only.
Mm-hmm.
Those things, I think, affected me because this book was in process before what the administration we're seeing now was in place.
Mm-hmm.
But it became to me even more important then when I saw and see what's happening, like with Charlottesville, to make sure that people learn about where and how we got so segregated, and the fact that because we live so separately, there can be no really understanding of one another.
Right. Yeah, and this is just, we've already sort of touched on this, but the book made me think so much about the power of fear and how it motivates us into anger and hatred and violence ultimately. And I thought it was very well drawn, you know, like particularly because, as I said before, this book evokes a certain time period, and it's a very innocent time in some ways, you know,
yeah.
Like the scenes where you're going on first dates with Bill, who I think ultimately became your husband, is that correct?
Still sleeping.
That's great. You know, there's a very sweet and innocent sweet and innocent feeling about those scenes. And like, for example, the scene when your neighbors move in next door and you and your mom come out to greet them and everybody's so polite and shaking hands and just, you know, generosity of people. And I feel like at our hearts, that's what we can be, and that fear creates so much ugliness. And the book really brought that out very well.
Well, I'm glad you found that because that's what I was trying to show, is to show this era that really was an innocent time, at least for children. The 50s was not a totally innocent era when we think about the Korean War and the communist
no,
threat.
Sure. Right.
But as a child in a neighborhood, and I think this is true for people all over the country who grew up in the 50s, they look back at that era as a time of tremendous freedom for children. We were kind of sent off on our own during the day. I had to check in now and then with my mom, but we definitely had to be home for supper, something that you can't imagine today. There were no organized sports. We didn't go to Little League. We had a pickup game on the corner, and you could walk through stores with your girlfriend like I did and have your picture taken in a photo booth and just kind of wander. And even, like you said, when I was dating, I mean, to me, it was a big deal if you kissed on the first date. That would be laughable today.
Yeah. Let's see.
Or my mom and dad sitting in Lincoln Park on their first date, and she writes, "We kissed for an hour and a half." You know, I mean, it's so cute and innocent, and her diaries are so innocent. She's 25 years old, and I swear they look to me like the diaries of a 15-year-old. She's so over the moon in love with my dad.
Yeah. What do you think each of them intended for their diaries? Like, do you think that they intended for you to find them, or do you think they just didn't think about it?
You know, I think my mother did intend for us to find her diaries, because as an only child, even though she had difficulties with her mother, she felt very special. She really always felt that she had a certain mission in this world, whatever it might be. And I think she started a diary at 10 because she was just infused with this confidence in herself. And she was a terrifically confident person in many ways. And liked to write. So for her, I mean, the fact that she started a diary at age 10 and kept it going virtually her whole life is really interesting to me. And my dad, he also liked to write. And of course, they were doing this separately. They hadn't met each other. He wrote poetry. He loved language. He would write things, just write notes down about words that he enjoyed. And I think that he wanted to record what was going on because it seemed significant to him, for whatever reason. But I know when I took his diaries to our local, well, it's not local, it's a National Research Center, the Newberry Library, because I wanted to have a place for all of these papers to be safe, the head of the Midwest Manuscripts at the Newberry Library looked at my father's diary and she said, "I have never seen a diary by a 19-year-old boy."
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so they're taking the entire collection when I ever get around to putting it all together for them.
That's wonderful.
But yeah, so why they? It's a puzzle. My mother-in-law would say, "Why would somebody do that?" But, you know, we have all these diarists, these famous people like the Diary of Aeneas Nin and Sylvia Plath. So a lot of people kept diaries. I think if you like to write and you like to express yourself, it's a great way to do it.
Yeah. And now at the beginning of the book, you include neighborhood maps that illustrate the changes in racial composition of the West Side neighborhoods in Chicago from 1940 through 1970. And I found that really interesting. And it made me think about gerrymandering. And I wondered, you know, like if we were to compare these maps, I'm wondering how much similarity there would be between the gerrymandering maps and the redlining maps.
Now, do you mean gerrymandering maps of our neighborhood or gerrymandering maps that we see created throughout the country?
Well, I think of your neighborhood as a place that we could look at those maps, but I imagine there are redlining maps from all over the country that would probably look a lot like their local gerrymandering maps, but I don't know.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes. Well, in regard to maps, these maps are just show the racial composition as it changes over time.
Right.
But what, again, your listeners would find very interesting, and I certainly have looked at a lot, is a site called mappinginequality.com. It is a site where a University of Virginia and at Richmond and other universities have digitized these homeowners loan corporation maps that color-coded neighborhoods for about 230 communities in the country. Now, I actually looked up Burlington, Vermont, and there isn't one for Burlington.
No, because we don't have much diversity even now, although we're getting there.
Right, but there was one for Manchester, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of close. So people can look at this. You can plug in the name of a state or a city and search to see what neighborhoods actually had been color-coded red, green, yellow, or blue. And it's really interesting because you'll see the ones that were red at that time are most likely still mostly black and segregated today.
Yeah.
So it's that. Now, that's not gerrymandering per se. That is,
no.
That was more a way of segregating people.
No, but I'm just wondering if there's overlap between that and the way that gerrymandering looks. I don't know.
Well, you know, my guess is that if you looked at maps, let's say, of these areas, let's say in Georgia, where they're concerned about gerrymandering, and if you looked at a redlining map, you would probably see that they have gerrymandered that in such a way to isolate the black vote.
Right, that's what I mean.
So that they can't have an influence on the election.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really horrible. And I think what happened with the Supreme Court a few years ago, where Roberts gutted the Voting Act's right.
Yeah.
That's horrible. This is not over.
Yeah. Okay. Now, your parents did not follow the advice of Blockbusters. They stayed in West Garfield, even after, you know, the crime was rising and riots were erupting. So why do you think they stayed?
You know, that is a good question, and I do explore it in the book. As I had mentioned earlier, you know, my dad looked at this as his neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
He was born there in 1914, and even though they were about the last white people around, I think he still felt, this is my neighborhood, and I am not going to be chased out by anything. He also had, even though he had a college degree, he had this history of being raised by his immigrant parents, who only had a fourth grade education but were very smart. And they made a good living and reached the American dream by being janitors. And so he grew up having to take care of buildings. It was almost a noble cause. My mother's parents also were landlords, not to the extent that my grandparents on my father's side were. But she had a very strong sense of duty. And once they decided that they were going to rent out these apartments, they had three small apartment buildings, one of which they acquired at the very last second when my grandparents skedaddled out of the community and dumped it on them.
That was a great scene where everybody's supposed to be so thankful.
Yeah, right, right. And, you know, and of course, in many ways, it was a great gift. I mean, it was worth $40,000 according to my grandmother's notes that I also have in all these papers I've inherited. So if they had just sold it, they would have been far better off. They would have been able to put all their kids through college with that money at that time and had money left over. But something made them keep the building, whether they thought it would make my grandparents unhappy that they sold it. And then my mother was like, okay, now there are only African Americans in the neighborhood. Clearly, I'm going to have to rent to African Americans. And she made up her mind. I remember her talking about this, that if she created the best apartments possible, which they always had anyway, but if she didn't take the attitude of all these absentee landlords like, oh, well, you know, we don't have to take care of those buildings because it's just blacks living there. I mean, she took the attitude that if I create and keep taking care of apartments and nurturing the quality of the apartments and my tenants, then I will get good tenants. And for the most part, she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think my mother really loved knowing African Americans. At one time, she writes about going to a wake, and she says, "Oh, these are all my old friends from the past. They are so boring compared to my African American tenants."
Yeah, yeah. But you know, you touch on a point that I really thought made the book very real, and I liked it a lot. You from the start, you sort of share that your parents did have fears about what was changing, and you don't paint them as sort of like heroic outliers who are going to stick it out and make friends and change the world. And you know, I think there would be the temptation to paint the story that way. But what they were people that, you know, came into a situation with the same cultural values as everyone else. And they chose a different path. And then I do think that their values were affected by the path they chose. But I thought it was a very real depiction. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. No, I realized early on that I couldn't paint my parents as great liberals because they weren't.
Right.
They were very conservative. Republican voters. They didn't believe in welfare. They didn't believe in, you know, because they felt we pulled ourselves up and that sort of thing. But I think they had a boldness in them. So they were, I will step back a minute, they also were afraid of African Americans moving into the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They did not know what to expect. As I said, whites and blacks led separate lives, and we saw no African Americans on television, not in movies for the most part. We didn't see them on billboards and magazines. It was like they almost didn't exist. So there was fear. And then, of course, the blockbusters enhanced that fear. But my parents didn't sell right away. And why they didn't, I think maybe they'd invested so much of their marital bond in these buildings, and so much effort and sweat that they just maybe couldn't feel they were just going to give it up. But because they stayed, they got to know their new neighbors.
Right.
And my mother actually said, you know, I'm not at all unhappy in this changing neighborhood. I like my neighbors. I like their children. My brother was playing with the African-American boy who moved down the block. So, you know, people's attitudes can change if you give the other person a chance.
Right. Now, one thing that we haven't talked about, which I thought was incredible, was that your dad had a job that took him away from home a lot. Like, he had to travel quite a lot. And so your mother was maintaining buildings and, you know, dealing with all the business of being a landlord or a landlady on her own and raising a young family. And sometimes, you know, early on, her mother was still living with you with her mental. Your mother had so much stress in her life. But I feel like that must have made her very strong. Is that how you see her in this mm-hmm. whole story?
You know, I did not realize the stress that my mother was under in the 1950s. I was a little girl. My parents never fought openly in front of us at that time. And it was only when I read the diaries that I realized how very unhappy my mother was.
Mm.
But it was sort of a catch-22. I mean, my dad lost his job just as they had bought this new home. They had a little baby, me, new children, and he didn't have a job. And this job came along, this job that required about 6 months a year of travel. And my mother wholly supported it to begin with. I mean, she even said to him, do everything you can to excel at this wonderful opportunity.
Right, right.
So she was behind him. But, of course, there's one thing to imagine what it's going to be like to be alone that long. Sometimes he was gone for 7 weeks at a time in the winter. And these were days of a coal-burning furnace, and you had to shovel coal
right,
into a furnace.
Right.
And if it got really cold, you had to go in the middle of the night down there and shovel coal. And so she was in charge of everything while he was gone, and she was always in charge of all the financials. And I would say my mother went into this as a very strong woman. She couldn't have survived this if she hadn't been a
okay.
strong woman.
Yep.
And so she had been the executive secretary for the president of the Bear Company, which to her seemed like the pinnacle of female achievement. And the same thing happened there. Because she was so competent, they kept piling on the work. Oh, you can do this. Let's give you some more. When she left that job, they had to hire two women to take her place.
Yeah, yeah.
So her whole life, she really, she was an achiever. And if she had been born, you know, 20 years later, she'd be the executive of some company.
I remember when I used to work in another kind of work. I worked in public relations for this big computer company. But anyway, I remember when new people would come to the job, the first piece of advice I would always give them is, if you figure out how to fix the Xerox machine, do not let anyone know that you have this skill. Because it is all you will do all day long.
Right. Oh, right, that's right. That's all you'll be called to do.
Right. So when I read that about your mother, I was thinking she knew how to fix the Xerox machine, or would have if they'd had that at the time.
That's right. I mean, the problem is she was so competent, and that she just kept taking on more and more work. And my dad just really, in the beginning, he was very solicitous. He'd write her, you know, don't take anything more on, send out the laundry, hire a cleaning lady. You know, you don't have to do this. But then every one of her letters is a litany of her chores and complaints.
Yeah.
So that eventually got old.
I'm sure, yeah. Let's see. We talked a little bit about this, but how long, all told, were you actually working on the book?
I knew you'd ask. That's a very hard question to answer because it wasn't a straight path.
Okay.
I took several side steps. So, you know, I first started reading the letters from World War II that I have in 2002, and the book was just published this last April.
Okay.
But I didn't work on it every day for all that time. I was very, very frustrated in many cases about what I should be doing with the book, what the focus should be. There was at one point where I started a blog called Family Archaeologist, which is still up on my website and is actually really, I think, very interesting. And I've heard from many people, they like it a lot, that looked at the history of my grandparents in Romania through their letters. Because my grandparents' history is very truncated in the book. So it's hard to say. I would say that probably it was around 2012 that I finally found my path.
Okay.
That's when I hired an editor to look at the sprawling manuscript I'd written and say, just tell me what you think doesn't fit, because I'm too close to it. And then once I started down that path where I had a goal and more of a central theme, I was able to start throwing things out, honing the writing. I mean, there are many, many passages that I wrote and rewrote and rewrote that are not in there.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to someday turn them into essays. Mm-hmm. And have a collection of essays of these things, because they're very interesting scenes, but they just had to go. So the answer is I can't tell you exactly how long it took me. I can tell you that from the time I started reading the diaries and letters and making notes and spreadsheets, that was 2002, and it was published in 2018. So that's that wasn't 16 years of solid writing on the book.
Okay. And then how did you find an editor to help you?
Okay. Well, I first would like to say, for people who are listening who are writers and want to write, I read tons of books about how to write a memoir. I read tons of memoirs. I constantly was studying memoirs to see how these excellent writers like Cheryl Strayed or Mary Carr did what they did.
Yeah.
So that was part of the process. And the way I found someone to help me, I kept taking classes. I mean, I had not been trained as a writer. I was a television producer, but that writing is very different. So I started taking classes at Northwestern. I would take online classes from Writer's Digest. And there's a book, a magazine called Creative Nonfiction.
Oh, yeah, it's a great one.
I love.
Yeah.
Okay, and so I took a class through them, and I loved my my instructor. Her name is Anjali Sachdeva, and she actually lives in the East Coast, and she has written a wonderful book called All the Names They Have for God.
Mm.
Anyway, I really enjoyed the way she responded to my essays. It was a memoir and essay writing class, so I asked her if she would be a mentor for me, because that's what creative nonfiction calls it. You hire a mentor, depending on the number of pages you have, and they charge you based on that. And then, she would start going through it. And then we kept working together. First, it was just this big overview, and then we started doing line-by-line editing, and we did that like two times. And then I started shopping it around, and eventually ended up with She Writes Press.
Yeah, okay. Great. Now, what might you have read recently that you would recommend to listeners? Do you have any titles that come to mind?
Well, one of my most recent books is Jesmyn Ward's Sing, Unburied, Sing.
Oh, yeah.
This is a two-time National Book Award winner, and she actually was the keynote speaker at our She Writes Press Authors Retreat just earlier this month.
Oh, right, yeah.
So that I loved. I'm reading now Lincoln and the Bardo, which I find fascinating.
Unbelievable, yes.
Yeah, just, my heart breaks for the President Lincoln.
Yes.
And then as far as, memoirs, I mean, I've just read tons of memoirs. One that nobody knows about anymore is written by Russell Baker, who used to be a columnist for the New York Times. He was born the same year as my uncle, 1924, but he writes about growing up during the Depression. It is delightful. It is funny, poignant, beautifully written, and just self-deprecating in the best way.
Oh, great.
Nobody knows about this anymore because he's from another era. I think he's still alive, but I went back to that memoir multiple times to just study how he did it.
Okay.
And I don't quite achieve his greatness, but he is delightful.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Growing Up.
Okay.
That's the first one. He wrote a second one, but I it's the first one I love so much. And it's just from a young boy's point of view, growing up with a single mom who is determined that he, quote, make something of himself,
right,
end quote. And that's the theme that runs through it, and it's really cute.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, are you writing anything new now?
Well, actually, right now I'm mainly focusing on just being able to talk about redlining. As I said, I'd really like to get some of these pieces that I have written really and honed into a book. But my goal is always to write something. I write for my blog. I write blog posts. And my goal is to get to more op-eds and things like that. But I've just been so kind of overwhelmed by the wonderful response to the book, and I'm doing a lot of speaking, like with you, and it's really, I just love it. It's just so much fun to hear what people have to say about it, and how interesting interviewers like you probe the book and the process.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. My last question for you has to do with blending memoir and history, and I just thought that was, it's just wonderful when that happens well in a book, you know, because it's we all can relate to the stories, the personal stories of the author, but then also the history is shared. It's sort of a universal history that we can learn more about, and that we can also, you know, sort of draw upon in integrating our own lives into our larger picture. So that is my last question for you. Do you have any advice for writers about blending memoir and history, and maybe some advice about doing the research that you know is necessary?
Right. Well, the research is necessary, and I think you just have to, a writer has to start with the books that seem to speak to them, that are dealing with their history. With the internet now, you can find anything. So, you know, depending on the history that you would like to relate in your book, I would just Google that history, and you'll immediately start finding articles and authors that have written books. I mean, I've got several books here. One of my more recent ones is The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, which really gives insight into the redlining policy. I would say it's a try and try again. I mean, when they say writing is rewriting, that is what it is. I mean, I have rewritten some of these passages probably 50 times. And I've also tried a variety of different ways to structure the book. I mean, and I would actually reach out to authors that I really liked the way they had structured their book, and ask them how they did it. And they can try to tell you, but you have to work on your own process. And I first wrote this book as all in a straight chronological line. I thought it was boring. Then I tried doing flashbacks every other chapter. That was confusing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just really, I put post-it notes on a bulletin board. I used Scrivener, which allows you to bring in photos and all sorts of ways of manipulating your manuscript, which is a great program. So it's really a matter, you just can't give up,
right,
is what it is. I kept trying and trying, and then it's like anything else. It's that process of trying that eventually has the breakthrough, and it's not like you sit down there and stare at the ceiling and inspiration comes. You work and work and work and work and work, and then something falls into place.
Yeah. Okay, that's
no
great.
Easy path.
No easy path, right. I was looking for just press the blue button.
Yeah, I thought there'd be a magic answer.
All right, well, Linda, I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Redlined, A Memoir of Race, Change, and Fractured Community in 1960s Chicago by Linda Gartz, and published by She Writes Press. Linda, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for your wonderful questions. I really enjoyed talking with you.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Linda Gartz about her book, Redlined. You can learn more about Linda's work, and there's a great deal about her research and other resources at her website, lindagartz.com. That's G-A-R-T-Z is her last name. So this week I have two Write the Book prompts to offer, both generously suggested by my guest, Linda Gartz. One is for memoir and the other for fiction. Here's Linda's memoir prompt. Write about an experience that has stayed in your memory, one that has meaning beyond the anecdote. Pick one. When did you feel humble, proud, ashamed, embarrassed, loved, or rejected? What made you feel that way, and what impact did that experience have on your future life, especially the way you dealt with future similar incidents, or how it shaped your thinking about and behavior in life? And then here's a prompt from Linda for fiction writers. Imagine a character who has one of these traits. The character is weak, kind, loving, arrogant, clueless to the impact his or her behavior has on others, or sneaky. And then write a scene in which the person demonstrates his or her character by showing the actions or words of this person, not by labeling the behavior. So, for example, don't say Jonathan was weak. Create a scene that shows his weakness. Show it on the page. So those will both be on the website, on the podcast site. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.